any hope the defense has of saving the life of Zhahar Tsarnaev, the admitted Boston Marathon bomber, is in convincing the jury that he was just a deadbeat, pot-smoking college student under the sway of his older brother, Tamerlan, the real jihadi. A demonstration of what they're up against came today with the first testimony from one of Zhahar's old friends, Stefan Silva. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
So first, before we get to the friend, Kevin, let's set this up. Top of the morning, and finally we get to the owner of that boat, the Slipaway 2, in which Zhahar Tsarnaev was found and captured to end the manhunt. And the manhunt had led to a shootout in Watertown first. That's a suburb of Boston. The death of the brother Tamerlan, and then the discovery of Zhahar in the boat in somebody's backyard. Now we get to David Henneberry, the boat's owner.
Yeah, you know, there had been something out there in the ether suggesting that this manifesto, this screed, this what the government would call a confession that Zhahar Tsarnaev left on the boat had been written in blood. Now we find out what that really was. It was a plumbing contractor's pencil. It was the plumbing contractor that happened to be the stepson of Dave Henneberry. It was his pencil that was on the boat. That was the pencil that Zhahar Tsarnaev picked up and wrote his manifesto.
This is the confession, the prosecution would say, that's been written out in pencil. And there was something else that was damaging today, and that was the production of that wooden slat in which is carved, "Stop killing our innocent people, and we will stop." It's not helpful for the defense.
No, it's not, because everything that was written on that boat fits the prosecution narrative, which is this is not a kid who was led by the nose by his jihadi, more extremist, more manipulative brother. This is someone who sat there for hours, who lay there for hours, and of his own volition wrote these words. And these words were stoked with what you would call jihadist language. It was talking about taking revenge for the actions of U.S. forces. He admitted to killing innocents.
Well, if there were a contest for the most unlikable prosecution witness in a trial in which we've had very compelling witnesses, Stefan Silva would win hands down.
Yeah, we heard from the heartbroken, the heroic, and the technically expert, and now we just hear from the sort of sullen degenerate speaking in a monotone. I don't know if you noticed, David, but I did. This was the first witness in which Zhahar Tsarnaev looked at him the entire time he was swearing in, because this wasn't a stranger. This was his friend. Just a few days after the Ides of March, we have him sitting there possibly thinking, "Et tu, Stefan, et tu."
This is what makes this an ancient story, and you've alluded to it here, is a friend, a defendant, turning on his former associate to get a better deal from the government. He has been charged with heroin trafficking, possession of a legal weapon. He's 21 years old. He's awaiting sentencing, and he's there for the deal.
This is not somebody who came forward after being horrified what happened at the Boston Marathon. He came forward and gave up his friend only trying to get himself a reduced sentence. That's all he's there for.
And this is what's become more and more common in federal courts across the country and in the Department of Justice. Criminal defense attorneys rail against it because it is about cutting a deal, and that deal is predicated on what you have to say. The feds will take you through it. They'll argue on your behalf to the judge, but only after they see how well you perform. And that means, according to criminal defense attorneys, that gives defendants incentives to lie, to say what the government wants them to say to get the deal. As criminal defense attorneys would tell you, were they to offer any kind of rewards to defendants,
yes, to be indicted,
witnesses, they'd be indicted, they'd be disbarred, they'd be charged with bribery. But
absolutely,
this is a form of extortion in which Stefan Silva's sentence hinges on how well he does according to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
We have to assume in this case, in which the evidence is so overwhelming, that the government made an assessment. It did a weighing operation, and it weighed and came to the conclusion that putting somebody up there as off-putting as Silver was, they decided it was worth doing, and obviously they decided is because Silver is the one who puts that Ruger, that pistol, that gun that was used to assassinate Sean Collier, that was used in the shootout in Watertown with the Watertown cops. That's the gun, and that was the gun put in the Tsarnaev's possession by Stefan Silva.
Here comes Silva. He has a swagger when he comes in, head kind of at an angle, and he's resistant to the friendly people, to the prosecutor asking him questions.
But, you know, at the end of that testimony, it struck me that Silva helped the defense as much, if not more, than he helped the prosecution today.
Well, let's hear what he had to say. And here's the first damage when they talk about lifelong friend. This is from Silva. He asked me to potentially borrow the gun. Now, Silva, who was dealing marijuana and other pharmaceuticals, I loved what he had to say. He said, well, the client demand.
Exactly. He was just an entrepreneur. He responds to his client's demand.
He had to expand his wares. That's right. So
obviously an adherent to Keynesian economics.
So he is selling marijuana, which in the weights that he's selling, it gets to be a dangerous business. So he acquires a gun. You can't make this up. He gets a gun from a guy named Howie, whose mother has found the gun. So now Stefan has the gun. He says that the Jahar asked me if he could potentially borrow the gun. Question, did he tell you why? Answer, he said he wanted to rip some kids from URI, the University of Rhode Island. So now we have established, one, Jahar's looking for a gun. Two, he has other criminal motives in mind, like robbing people, a little different than the defense's portrayal of him. Later, Silva says, we hung out. I gave him the gun. I remember him saying a little later on, he wanted food for the dog.
Which was?
Ammunition. So now we have Jahar, the stoner and slacker, looking for food for the dog. So we've now put real criminal motivation into him and into his mind. And this looks bad for Jahar because Silva says he expected the gun back. He wanted the gun back. He loaned it to Jahar in February 2013, and he didn't get it back. Now, I thought the evidence that he had to offer, we were wondering what these friends could give up on him. The prosecutor has him testify that he was in the house, and we see a flag associated, a black and white flag of Arabic origins, and it's associated with jihadist groups. That's on his wall. They're also watching, The Walking Dead?
The Walking Dead on the computer, and it's that sort of awkward juxtaposition of what stoner kids do. They get high and they watch shows like The Walking Dead, and then on the wall is this. It's a flag that's been hijacked by Islamist groups, such as Al-Qaeda, but it's not necessarily Islamist.
Now, we've run this into the ground, that the defense is a desperate defense. And yet here, although we were holding our noses at this guy, it looks like the prosecution is on a real roll. Suddenly, Miriam Conrad, an experienced defense attorney and a savage cross-examiner, starts asking questions.
She really laid into Silva. The funny thing is, Miriam Conrad's best contributions as a defense attorney today were actually objected to by the prosecution. They were sustained by the judge, but the jury heard every word of it.
She establishes early on, so you said you were shocked. You'd never seen anything in Jahar that would make him do something like that. He looks at her. He said, you were in the Rolling Stone article, weren't you? You were the guy named Sam. And then she starts quoting, Sam calls Jahar one of the realest dudes I ever met in my life. He wasn't violent. He says, no, I've never seen him violent. You never saw him fight with anybody? No, I did not. He was humble? Yes, he was. And it's somewhere in this, Kevin, I look at Miriam. She's coming back to ask another question. She turns away to come back, and she has the smile of the cat that's catching the canary. And she knows she's scoring. You never heard him say anything to indicate he ever had a resentment toward America. No, that undercuts the whole business about what he wrote in the boat, what he carved in the boards, other stuff that the government wanted to associate with him. Now she gets to the gun, and I thought the gun, and here's the business with the judge sustaining the government's objections, but her still getting points in. Did it occur to you that he didn't have the gun? Did you ask him? And here is the suggestion that she got into the jurors, that in fact he had given the gun to his brother.
Tamlin, the question, I remember that killer question that she had, would you have loaned the gun if he had told you it was for his brother? The jury heard it.
Yep. He wouldn't be able, and then she makes the point, just to make it clear to the jurors, and this was stunning, that today, this very day, was to be sentencing day for Silva because he's pled guilty. And of course, they don't sentence him today because they want to see how well he performs. You're singing for your supper. If he doesn't sing enough, he's not getting supper.
Yeah, Chakravarti get back up there and clawed back a little, but I agree with you. I think that that was very effective for the defense to point this out. This kid's testimony is more or less bought and paid for because the only thing he has to trade for is a reduction of his sentence. Does not mean that any and everything he said up there today was untrue. It's just the jury heard that he got up there because it was good for him. Not good for anybody else.
In her parting shot, Miriam Conrad says, well, you had a deal with the government, and you say it was to tell the truth, but you've already lied to them, haven't you?
It's beyond lying. It's basically, Miriam Conrad said, even while he's in jail, awaiting these charges and awaiting to testify, he's committing crimes. She said he was making homemade alcohol down there.
Objection. Sustained. She gets on the record. What was the next one?
Getting friends with fake IDs and to see him. Basically saying the government was turning a blind eye to whether he was moonshining or moonlighting as a phony ID guy.
Sustained. But she got it. The jurors heard every word she said. This is the end of day 8 from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston. This is Finish Line. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen for the Boston Globe.
Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.